Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hi, everybody. Daniel from the Cannonball here, co-host of your favorite quarterly literature podcast. Apologies about the surfeit of episodes lately, but we have a great raft of episodes coming up all about lyrical ballads. So we're going to be releasing those pretty close together to each other to kind of hopefully make up a little bit for our rather reduced release schedule lately. But in the meantime, hey, if you're waiting for more Cannonball, the best thing you can do is check out our sister shows on the Agora Podcast Network, exactly the kind of shows that an intellectually curious type of person of the sort who might listen to the Cannonball would really enjoy. And I would particularly urge you to check out the Bohemican podcast from our colleague Pete Coleman. It is your one-stop shop for all things Czechia and Bohemia. It is a wonderful podcast delving into all sorts of topics in the history and culture of the Czech lands and the Czech people. So please check out Bohemican Podcast and enjoy as your favorite co-host and mine, Claude Myron Guzer, and I dig a little deeper into lyrical ballads.
Welcome to the Cannonball, a podcast attempt to read all of the books in Harold Bloom's list of the books of the Western canon. Sorry it took so long to get back, but we're back, and we're back with lyrical ballads. This is Claude Myron Guzer, and with me as always is my co-host Daniel Doherty. Daniel, how you doing, man? You feeling rustic tonight?
I am feeling rustic. I'm feeling bucolic. I am feeling as though I am traipsing in an idyll. Really, I mean, just the whole shebang. Yeah.
Yeah.
The whole thing just feels very, very, Georgic. Mm-hmm. It feels very, I already said bucolic. I'm running out of vocabulary words.
Well, are you bearing witness to any dispossessed people?
Buddy, you better believe I am here to tell the story of enclosure and industrialization and to set the stage for J.R.R. Tolkien's Hobbits.
All right. So our plan is to take on the bulk of the 1798 lyrical ballads. We did the Rime of the Ancient Mariner already, and sorry we took like a longer hiatus than we intended. We thought we could just kind of bang this out, but we're living in unprecedented times, and they're very busy unprecedented times, and these times are asking a lot of us. So our apologies. Can you feel the angst coming through? But what our plan is to do everything in the 1798 lyrical ballads tonight, except for Tintern Abbey. So we're going to proceed after like everything after Rime of the Ancient Mariner, and then everything up to Tintern Abbey, because I think Tintern Abbey needs its own show. It needs its own mm-hmm. episode. because it is such a huge chunk, though there are, let's call them intimations of Tintern Abbey sort of scattered throughout lyrical ballads. Mm-hmm. Now, we've already sort of discussed the weirdness of starting with Rime of the Ancient Mariner. Like, it's such a distinctive and strange and bizarre performance. Though, looking back, like, having read the rest of the book, like, in a concentrated way, I take back some of what I said. There's a lot in this collection that really is goth as fuck.
Yeah, that's very true.
it still plays with the supernatural in parts. Mm-hmm. It still plays with some of those goth tropes. I mean, particularly Coleridge, in some of the sections that he took from dramatic works that he was using. It mm-hmm. still plays in a lot of the supernatural gothic tropes, but it really sort of filters throughout. So you've got the bucolic sort of as you advertise, and you've got that sort of a kind of natural transcendentalism. Mm-hmm. Like, Wordsworth will sort of pop it in here and there. But you've also got, like, these darker tones coming throughout, and this sort of, I guess what you would call poetry of witness.
Yeah.
This was really kind of an interesting read, because I've read these poems individually scattered throughout anthologies. I think my first major exposure to lyrical ballads and to Wordsworth and Coleridge came in an undergrad romantics class. And I remember having read all this stuff. And in grad school, I went back and re-encountered everything, you know, with every poet in their own place, a giant selected of Wordsworth, a giant selected of Coleridge, so on and so forth. But I'd never read all the poems together in one place in this way. And yeah. It was kind of surprising, you know, I sort of knew what I would be looking at to a degree, but it was surprising what was there, but also what wasn't there. There are some heavy hitters that I think get added to the later editions. And it was sort of surprising to see that some of the stuff that I was expecting, particularly the transcendental stuff, it doesn't quite get fleshed out here. It was really sort of interesting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's very, it's oblique, in a way. It's almost kind of, well, I mean, I don't know if this is the term to use, but it's sort of transcendentalism haunted rather than, mm-hmm. Kind of upfront. Yeah.
Except for Tintern Abbey.
right, which is pretty explicit.
Sort of like the glaring omission there.
Yeah.
But it was really sort of fascinating to see how their project was proceeding. So after Rime of the Ancient Mariner, we get this fragment. It's another fragment from Coleridge. It's the Foster Mother's Tale, where it's a piece of a play that he sort of excerpted out. And there's another piece of that same play that he excerpts out. And this plays on, it's sort of like a narrative told through the dialogue between a mother and a girl and her foster mother. Mm-hmm. And it plays on so much of the gothic weirdness that we were sort of seeing back in Rime of the Ancient Mariner. You have a boy who is sort of raised in this kind of naturalist pantheistic type religion who butts heads with the Catholic Church. So mm-hmm. he's thrown into the well as a kind of John the Baptist figure. But it's playing on a lot of the gothic gloominess that you find in, you know, literal gothic novels, like the gothic novels of the 18th century.
Yeah.
That's what I thought was sort of interesting and evocative about it. And then we have the lines left upon a seat in a yew tree, which stands near the lake of Esthwaite. And that's one that seems like a run-up to Tintern Abbey. Mm-hmm. It's about a sort of like solid the narrator, the speaker is urging a traveler to sit and rest under this tree and to contemplate sort of the carvings into the tree. But what happens is the carvings were left there by someone who was kind of like a natural rustic genius, but who instead of finding the interconnectedness with all things, gets so entranced with the beauty without that he becomes a solipsist, which was this kind of romantic fear. It says he was one who owned no common soul in youth, by genius nursed and big with lofty views. He to the world went forth pure in his heart against the taint of dissolute tongues, against jealousy and hate and scorn, against all enemies prepared, all but neglect. And so his spirit damped at once with rash disdain, he turned away and with the food of pride sustained his soul in solitude. Okay, so that would seem like, you know, this I guess, benevolent Wordsworthian figure, you know, who goes out and sustains themselves in solitude. But hang on, stranger, these gloomy boughs had charms for him, and here he loved to sit, his only visitants, a straggling sheep, the stone chat, or the glancing sandpiper, and on these barren rocks with juniper and heath and thistle thinly sprinkled o'er, fixing his downward eye, he many an hour a morbid pleasure nourished, tracing here an emblem of his own unfruitful life, and lifting up his head, he would then gaze on the more distant scene, how lovely 'tis thou seest, and he would gaze till it became far lovelier, and his heart could not sustain the beauty still more beauteous. Nor that time would he forget those beings to whose minds, warm from the labors of benevolence, the world and man himself appeared a scene of kindred loveliness. Then he would sigh with mournful joy to think that others felt what he must never feel, and so lost man on visionary views would fancy feed till his eyes streamed with tears. In this deep vale he died, this seat his only monument. He becomes a kind of like solipsist of the spirit. Mm-hmm. He becomes so sort right, of yeah, go ahead.
Well, I thought the kind of the most telling term used in there was emblem of his own unfruitful life. Uh-huh. Like clearly, like, you know, you like, what is the point of having such a great spirit, this, you know, tremendous, you know, well of spirit in you, if all it does is, you know, you enter the world and instead see that, like, well, it's not even worthy coming to contact with my great and bounteous spirit within.
Exactly.
There's not much, you know, is that greatness of spirit? I mean, of course, Wordsworth here is saying, well, no, it's not.
Yeah. So it's that inward turn, or it's an inwardness that, you know, is threatening. And then it sort of comes with the moral, if thou be one whose heart the holy forms of young imagination have kept pure, stranger, henceforth be warned, and know that pride, howe'er disguised in its own majesty, is littleness. That he who feels contempt for any living thing hath faculties which he has never used, that thought with him is in its infancy. So, you know, it kind of goes to, you know, Rime of the Ancient Mariner in a way. Mm-hmm. You know, you're sort of pridefully distancing yourself out from everyone and everything and losing yourself in your own solipsistic vision.
So I would see this as a kind of, this is a bit of a broadside against the concept of mysticism itself.
Yeah.
Right. Like a kind of, like you're not going the inward turn. Right. I mean, and that's, you know, mystic and mysticism are of course very vague and broad terms.
Right.
but you know, I think something you might say that, you know, everything that we call mystic, you know, all the traditions that we refer to as mystic have in common this notion of the inward turning, that the path to transcendence is one of contemplation within and abstract, using abstracted forms to find that. And yeah, here's Wordsworth just saying like, well, no, you're just kind of playing with yourself.
Well, you know, it's interesting because in the previous poem, the sort of tragic hero was the boy who was tossed in the well for doing the same thing. Mm-hmm. And it's sort of like, this is the counterbalance in some way, you know, you have to be very, very cautious about that. I mean, I think we already talked about this at one point, but Byron in Lord Juan. Okay. Yes, yes, yes. It's pronounced Juan. All right. We all know that.
And Byron, not the Byron, Spanish, though.
But Byron also pronounced it Juan. And we know because he rhymes Juan with new one.
Right. Right.
But he, in Don Juan, when Juan first, comes to understand, sexuality, mm-hmm. he's so repressed. Like, his mother has kept biology from him to such a degree that he doesn't know what's going on, and he doesn't even know that he's being aroused by this young woman, who's, you know, 5 years older than he is. And she's the wife of this old, ugly dude. And so she knows what she's doing, but Juin doesn't quite get it. And it's all sort of innocent until it's not. And so he is wandering in the forest, and it's this great moment of Byron basically mocking Coleridge and Wordsworth, because Juin is wandering through the forest expostulating on all kinds of transcendental metaphysics until he just can't stop thinking of Donna Julia. What Byron is getting at there is that all of this, you know, as you said, mysticism, it literally is just playing with yourself. It's sexual repression. It's a form of masturbation. Yeah. And it's just interesting that Wordsworth here, you know, on the heels of, I guess we're talking about how they structured the volume, on the heels of Coleridge's, you know, sort of meditation on that, the punishment for that inward turn, he has this other kind of punishment for that inward turn, which would be solipsism, the mm-hmm. cutting yourself off from all of the social. So he doesn't need to be thrown down a well. He threw himself down a well, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I'm almost seeing this as a kind of, and I'm sure as with all my observations, I'm sure none of them are very fresh and have been gone over many times in the critical literature.
Same
it seems
here.
To me that, it seems to me that that Wordsworth is in conversation with himself over the dangers of the contemplative life, you know, like it's one of sort of feeling out the borders and the range of it, and like finding I guess what we might call a raised path through this sort of deceptive morass almost.
Yeah. Yeah. And it comes up again in other of the romantics. I hate to keep branching out here, but in Percy Shelley's Alastair or Alaster, that sort of idea of the romantic hero quester is ultimately being a solipsist is front and center. And Shelley most likely was satirizing Wordsworth and satirizing that turn. Mm-hmm. He sort of exoticizes the quest in certain ways. And Alastair is it's a fun poem. It's, you know, the exoticizing is fun to read, but it really is, you know, the search for the feminine spirit within, the perfect twin to this soul. And it just becomes this dude hiding out in a cave masturbating. We're back to Goethe again. My God.
Goethe and Montaigne. Who would have guessed? Those are the two most enduring canoneers.
Sheesh. All right. So The Nightingale, by Coleridge, I found to be kind of this interesting poem about sort of thwarting the tropes of poetry and sort of pointing to their artificiality. And it's trying to make a case for, I guess what later critics are going to critique the romantics for doing, sort of burying the rhetoric or burying the rhetorical turn. I'm not quite sure. You know, after having spent time with the poems in this way and sort of looked around at what else was on the scene, that I still buy this argument. I buy it to a degree, but you know, the argument goes that the romantics tried to claim that they were not rhetoricians. They were presenting the real as real. And so there's this attempt to get out of the falsification of rhetoric. But if you're writing, then necessarily you're involved in the rhetorical process. And I think it's pretty clear that most of these poems are written as argument poems. They're sort of observation arguments, sort of to put you in the place of, hey, okay, what do you make of this? I think, Garner and Porter do a really great job in the intro of pointing to the way that so many times these poems draw the reader in. There's a sort of direct address to the reader to come in and okay, I'm presenting the scene, but you make meaning out of it, right? And we're being called to engage. But Coleridge here is sort of playing with that back and forth because he's questioning the very idea that the song of the nightingale is a melancholy song. It says, most musical, most melancholy bird, a melancholy bird. Oh, idle thought. In nature, there's nothing melancholy. Like, yo, bird can't think. It's kind of silly to think that the bird has these kinds of feelings when what is the bird doing when it's singing? It's calling to a mate or you know, contesting its territory or doing something other.
I was going to say, if anything, I think birds are sanguine 201.
Yeah.
Yeah. Nothing melancholy about it. Yeah. They're always out trying to get laid or start a fight.
Well, that's kind of Coleridge's point.
Yeah.
This is a really stupid digression. It makes me think of John Waters. I think it's in Pink Flamingos. One of the characters is disgusted with nature. It's one of the it's either Pink Flamingos or Female Trouble. One of the characters is disgusted with the natural world, and he looks out and says, "Think of all those birds in the tree just shitting and fucking." It's like, yeah, that's kind of what's going on, right?
Yeah,
and that's what Coleridge sort of, well, in less vulgar terms, that's what he sort of points us to. He talks about how, you know, by sun or moonlight, to the influxes of shapes and sounds and shifting elements surrendering his soul spirit of his song and of his fame forgetful, so his fame should share in nature's immortality a venerable thing. And so his song should make all nature lovelier and itself be loved like nature, right? So this is what the song is. You got to go outside at night to experience it, but it's yet another beauty of the natural world, even if it's at night, even if it is at this sort of darkened time. This is, but 'twill not so, and youths and maidens most poetical who lose the deepening twilights of the spring in ballrooms and hot theaters, they still full of meek sympathy must heave their sighs or Philomela's pity pleading strains. All right. So, he's sort of critiquing all these indoor poets who don't get outside and just rely on the old myth of Philomela and the melancholy myth of, you know, the trauma that produces the nightingale and its song. He's like, this is nonsense. And then he sort of ends with this description of dragging his son out. Well, he calls it a love chant. Okay. But then he ends with this description of, you know, waking up his son in the middle of the night and going out and hanging and listening to the birds. It says, and I deem it wise to make him nature's playmate. He knows well the evening star. And once when he awoke in most distressful mood, some inward pain had made up that strange thing, an infant's dream. I hurried with him to our orchard plot and he beholds the moon and hushed at once, suspends his sobs and laughs most silently. While his fair eyes that swam with undropped tears did glitter in the yellow moonbeam. Well, it is a father's tale, but if that heaven should give me life, his childhood shall grow up familiar with these songs, that with the night he may associate joy, right? It sort of turns into this you know, it starts with this kind of like castigation of the falsification of experience or the turning of experience into artifice. And then this exploration of bringing his son out into the world at night so that night can also be a source of joy, sort of like psychological association. And so what I thought was fascinating there was this kind of like argument, and I would call it a rhetorical argument, against the a certain kind of aestheticization. As a dude who just went out with his sons to test out their new light up sneakers and just go running through the neighborhood in the middle of the night, it kind of hits home.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, that was something I really rang true with me as well. And partly because like, I don't know that anyone would describe it as melancholy or whatever, but, here's a little slice of life from Central Alabama. We don't have where I live. I'm in the county. I'm not within any municipal boundaries. So we don't have recycling pickup. So we do keep all our recyclables in some bins, and there's a public drop-off that you can drive out to. Mm-hmm. And this actually just so happens to be on the same road that the house I grew up is on. It's right next to where they built a big new stadium for high school football. And so part of that complex, there's this the public recycling drop-offs. Now, mm-hmm. typically what I'll do is after I've, you know, put my kid to bed, mm-hmm. One night a week, I'll drive out there to drop off the recycling. And over the summer, I've noticed it somehow it always ended up that, like, I typically would be dropping it off on nights where it was cool but humid, and I could see lightning storms down the valley one way or the other. Mm-hmm. And it's also – it's in this low area nearby a creek. And so the whole world is just filled with the sounds of singing tree frogs, and they're all just singing away. And I mm-hmm. and I'm dropping off – I'm here – you know, pulling trash out of my car and walking it over to, sometimes there's like a lacrosse game going on or something, you know, like with folks hearing the buzz of the fluorescent lights around a stadium and whatever. But I can see these flashes of lightning and I can hear these frogs, and just my heart is just filled to bursting with love for this land that I live in, this yeah. place. And I don't know if I'm just getting so much more sentimental in my old age or what it is, but there's something about, like, you know, cause if you just describe it, it's like, oh, running to take recycling and dumping it over by the dumpsters next to the high school football field. It sounds ugly. It sounds dismal, but it's not. I mean, every time there's something wonderful in it, there's something that touches it, either the feel of the wind as I, you know, I'm walking the trash over, I hear these tree frogs who I love to bits. And, yeah. and it really rang true to me.
Yeah. There is something that I think these poems do that sort of, like, turn your focus towards something else. Mm-hmm. That's what I sort of found rereading them, that it does make you focus on, I guess, the overlooked parts of the environment around you. You know, I find that to be a very valuable thing, a very precious thing, to just mm-hmm. stop and look. And I guess that gets us to the first of these sort of poems of observation, The Female Vagrant.
Yeah. Yeah. This one was pretty fascinating to me. This one really struck a chord for me, because I recall, loyal listeners will recall that I had a lot to say about enclosure and industrialization and the demise of the English village when we did our kind of table setting episode for the lyrical ballads. And boy, this was one where that was just at the fore.
Yeah.
The whole narrative. Because it's like a story. And again, this is one that's like, it's this interesting kind of, this parenthetical approach to introducing the speaker in these poems, which yeah. I guess is because we are assuming that the speaker is Wordsworth or Coleridge, I guess, or, you know, Coleworth or something.
Yeah.
Like some sort of like authorial voice, unless otherwise specified.
Right.
So this one starts off, by Derwent's side, my father's cottage stood, and in parentheses, the woman thus her artless story told, close mm-hmm. parentheses. One field, a flock, and what the neighboring flood supplied to him were more than mines of gold. Light was my sleep, my days in transport rolled. With thoughtless joy, I stretched along the shore my father's nets, or watched when from the fold high o'er the cliffs, I led my fleecy store a dizzy depth below his boat and twinkling oar. So, setting it, and also I would think, like, artless is not quite, you know, the narrative is not artless whatsoever, but maybe that's
right.
The poet has helped her along.
Yeah. And it's this kind of claim that this is unadorned, right? Or it's not. Okay,
yeah. That's artless, less in the sense of ugly and unfashioned, but rather artless in the sense of guileless.
Yeah, which is also okay. goes back to that claim that this isn't a rhetorical performance, even though, you know, it is a rhetorical
Clearly
performance.
Clearly it is, yeah.
Observation, yeah, yeah. even if it is observation where you tell the reader, okay, just pay attention, is still a rhetorical performance.
Yeah. Know?
But yeah, so her father loses the land. He's kind of bullied out of it.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah. And is then, right. So, there's, here we go. I thought this was very evocatively done. Then rose a mansion proud our woods among, and cottage after cottage owned its sway. No joy to see a neighboring house or stray through pastures not his own, the master took. My father dared his greedy wish gainsay. He loved his old hereditary nook, and ill could I the thought of such sad parting brook. But when he had refused the proffered gold, to cruel injuries he became prey, sore traversed in whatever he bought and sold. His troubles grew upon him day by day, till all his substance fell into decay, his little range of water was denied. All but the bed where his old body lie, all was seized, and weeping side by side, we sought a home where we uninjured might abide. And there, of course, folks, you have enclosure, the expulsion of traditional tenants and the traditional sort of village life, sacrificed at the altar of the landlord's whim or his desire to find a more profitable use for this land where these peasants happen to live and have been living forever and really love. I mentioned at the top of the show, the kind of setting up for Tolkien's nostalgia for an England which may or may not have ever existed. Right. And this is the England which died that Tolkien mourns. But the rest of the kind of the narrative is one of, catastrophe that eventually the woman narrating, she and her husband have to, they have to emigrate to a town. Which is, there you go. That's the creation of the English working class right there. Like, yeah. You're kicked off your land. So what else can you do? You go to a town and try to find some work. Which, the grind doesn't work there, and they eventually are. And I guess the way I know, Claude, you could maybe clarify, it read to me like they were either emigrating purposefully or were transported to Australia. Or some kind of far overseas British settlement.
I'm not quite sure. I sort of took it as the New World.
Mm-hmm.
Just because it sounds like they were attacked by pirates.
Right.
I'm not trying to be glib or stupid. It really does sound as if they were raided. Mm-hmm. In some capacity, yet does that burst of woe congeal my frame when the dark streets appeared to heave and gape, while like a sea the storming army came, and fire from hell reared his gigantic shape, and murder by the ghastly gleam and rape seized their joint prey, the mother and the child. But from these crazing thoughts my brain escaped. For weeks the balmy air breathed soft and mild, and on the gliding vessel heaven and ocean smiled. It sounds as if they were sort of engaged in some kind of martial raid, and piracy was often a cover. It was international naval warfare by by way of mercenaries. Pirates.
Right. It was a very common kind of accomplishing one's foreign policy goals through the use of violence, theft, and rapine. By hiring it out to privateers and whatnot.
It seemed to me that they go, maybe I've got too much of this in mind, they go to, and now to the seacoast with numbers more we drew, they go to some kind of seacoast town, and then from there out to somewhere else. They're foul neglect for months and months we bore, nor yet the crowded fleet its anchor stirred. Green fields before us and our native shore by fever from polluted air incurred, ravage was made for which no knell was heard. Fondly we wished and wished away, nor knew mid that long sickness and those hopes deferred that happier days we never more must view. The parting signal streamed, and at last the land withdrew. That's such a weird way of saying they got on a boat. At last the land withdrew. It's as if the earth itself is going away. But from
it centers the vagrant woman. She is the pole, and all of this is, everything moves in relation to her. yeah. In a way. Yeah.
So it's not quite clear to me where they go. I hadn't been thinking mm-hmm. of Australia, but it might be. I thought it was the Atlantic because
I realized I was basing my Australia theory on a misreading of a word. Where in the stanza where it starts, but from delay, the summer calms were passed on as we drove the equinoctial deep. Right. I realized I read that as equatorial. So so I thought they were crossing the equator to then reach whatever, wherever they were going.
Okay. Cause anyway, it struck me that they were perhaps going for the New World, maybe the Caribbean, maybe. Mm-hmm. You know, the American South or something like that. But whatever happened, it seems they were raided. Eventually, her whole family is killed and she gets on a boat and gets taken back. But she's sort of robbed of her reason. She has no connections left. She gets taken up with a group of, I guess travelers, what, you know, if you'll pardon the slur, and I understand that it is a slur, but what mm-hmm. would have been called at the time gypsies. She gets taken up with this group that are sort of like, homeless travelers who, break into people's houses and steal a bunch of things.
Yeah.
And she can't bring herself to do that. So she's cast out. She has nowhere to go. And she just kind of breaks off. She says, 3 years a wanderer often have I viewed in tears the sun towards that country tend where my poor heart lost all its fortitude. And now across this moor my steps I bend. Oh, tell me whither, for no earthly friend have I. She ceased and weeping turned away as if because her tale was at an end. She wept. Mm-hmm. Because she had no more to say of that perpetual weight which on her spirit lay, as if her tale was at an end.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the horrible suggestion is that she's going to survive.
Yeah.
Like she's going
to
go on.
That there's more calamity to be had.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's what I was calling a poem of observation because it doesn't have like a clear point. It's just look, mm-hmm. listen, bear witness.
Right. Right.
You know, it doesn't have a call to action. It doesn't have a sort of moral at the end like Simon Lee seems to have.
Mm-hmm.
It's just, this is. And that's really heartbreaking.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this was one of the ones that, that affected me most. And yeah. And it might be just that kind of bearing witness. And I know that's kind of a, you know, you mentioned that it doesn't have any kind of call to action or anything. It's just there for you to bear witness to and have this kind of misfortune in mind. And it does bring to mind the kind of despair or a critique of what a lot of political energy tends toward especially in the United States of America in the 21st century, where it does seem like the best any political formation is going to offer you if you do have an interest in the suffering and exploitation and misfortune of people caught up in things that are beyond their control, that the best any political formation is going to do is to say that they see that that's happening to you and acknowledge it.
Yeah.
And that's all that, and that's all the word. And so this idea that that's kind of the limiting horizon on, you know, quote unquote, you know, permissible political engagement with misfortune born of political choices.
Right.
It rang a bit of a bell. Yeah. And it's interesting but there is that kind of the tradition of the bearing witness and there is something more.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
And which is honestly, which is also not to denigrate it, because I think, of course, one must have some idea, right? Like it, you don't have the limited and flawed progressive movement of the early 20th century without how the other half lives.
Right.
You know?
Right.
But it still is a kind of like, well, it's, you know, kind of calling back to the kind of the solipsism of earlier. Like there's also a tendency toward inertness in it that you just take it in rather than, you know, find the fulcrum to move something.
And I mean, I do wonder what can be done in those moments.
Mm-hmm.
And then we have our Tales from the Crypt story. Here's Goody Blake and Harry Gill. Right.
It is a real switch up. I think that's interesting. Also, you brought up the tale of Simon Lee, and that's one that I think has a lot of, it kind of, sorry to use this expression, it rhymes with The Vagrant Woman. It's sort of in the same wheelhouse, but it is like, instead of connecting them directly, we have, that's sort of the Tales from the Crypt, Goody Blake, and then a cute poem about a kid.
Yeah. A kid going,
but anyway,
to tell,
continue.
It's really very strange. Simon Lee matches up with a female vagrant, which matches up with a thorn, which matches up with, the Mad Mother, which matches up with, like, it's kind of like a line with all these things, but they keep being disrupted by, okay, so lines written a small distance from my house and sent by my little boy to the person to whom they are addressed. It's the speaker writing to his sister. So this is a common Wordsworthian thing. He was very close to his sister and she sort of helped him around the house. She lived with them in the cottage. It's basically, all right, let's get out. It's a beautiful day. Get out here. Put everything aside. You have to experience this. No joyless form shall regulate our living calendar. We from today, my friend, will date the opening of the year. Love, now universal birth from heart to heart, is stealing from earth to man, from man to earth. It is the hour of feeling. Now, I think a lot of times this gets taken as Wordsworth's, like, let's just put everything aside and just feel, man. And, you know, no more intellect. We're just, you know, emotional beings. I don't think that's actually what he's saying. This is an intimation of that kind of transcendentalism that comes full force in, Tintern Abbey. That's what it strikes to me. It's moving away from a kind of mechanical, a mechanical time, a mechanical state of being, to a state of being that is intuitively interconnected with all things in that kind of Buddhist way that he sort of gets at in Tintern Abbey. One moment now may give us more than 50 years of reason. Our minds shall drink at every pore the spirit of the season. Some silent laws our hearts may make, which they shall long obey. We for the year to come may take our temper from today. It's a kind of rejuvenation, based on this interconnectedness that he feels in the moment and this desire to share it with someone he cares about. This, I think, is sort of like the positive side of, the earlier poem that was sort of like centered on solipsism, because this is a desire to share with others and to feel with others. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
That seems extraordinarily important to Wordsworth. The fact that, when we reach these transcendental heights, we can't do it individually, but it has to be an interconnectedness of beings and people with people. It's not antisocial. He doesn't want to make it antisocial, you know?
Yeah.
And then we have Simon Lee.
Yes.
It's like, why disconnect these things? And so Simon Lee is another one of these. It's sort of like an observational poem about a man who used to work for the Lord, and his means of work are outmoded, outdated. Mm-hmm. And he was never trained as a farmer, but as an old man with very little strength left, he has to basically make a subsistence living.
Mm-hmm.
So the narrator sees him trying to pull up a root one day, or, you know, and he can't do it. And it's got this very curious ending. One summer day, I chanced to see this old man doing all he could about the root of an old tree, a stump of rotten wood. The mattock tottered in his hand, so vain was his endeavor that at the root of the old tree, he might have worked forever. "You're overtasked, Simon Lee. Give me your tool," to him I said. And at the word, right gladly, he received my proffered aid. I struck, and with a single blow, the tangled root I severed, at which the poor old man so long and vainly had endeavored. The tears into his eyes were brought, and thanks and praises seemed to run so fast out of his heart, I thought they never would have done. I've heard of hearts unkind, kind creeds with coldness still returning. Alas, the gratitude of men has oftener left me mourning. Mm. There, you know, I'm grateful to the introduction to this edition that they point out that this is a very strange moment that we may not know how to read. There are multiple interpretations of this happening all at once.
Mm-hmm.
Is Simon Lee actually glad that someone intervened? Was the intervention a positive intervention? Is this a sort of imposition into the life and dignity of this man? Or is this man really so grateful that it breaks the heart of the narrator? All of these interactions are contained therein. And what's complicated is that the poem wants us to make a sort of moral observation, but a clear observation of what occurred is really kind of beyond us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I had that more or less straightforward reading of like the narrator being almost sort of taken aback by the effusive gratitude of Simon Lee, and sort of in reflecting on it, recognizing, you know, I guess, you know, thinking like, you know, left in mourning, like thinking about, God, what would my life have to be like for someone just doing this little thing to mean that much to me? And then that sort of welling up as this feeling of mourning. But I realize now, like as is typically the case for me, that's a very naive reading, a very superficial one.
No, I don't know. And I might be overcomplicating this. Again, we're talking about past reading interfering into the present reading. You know, sure. I think of Don Quixote and every time Don Quixote right. tried to when he tried to stop the whipping of this kid who context tells us really was a thief, you know, it goes wrong in five different kinds of ways at once. You know, what is it when we intervene into someone else's life? I try to be very, very okay. Mm-hmm. As a teacher, I try to be very, very careful of that. You know, if I'm concerned about a student and I show too much attention, then that becomes a kind of, you know, negative intervention. If I show no attention, then that also can be, you know, a damaging thing. I have to think very clearly about how best to engage, or if I need to engage, or you know what I mean? It's mm-hmm. What do we do when we enter into the lives of others and assume that we can do something, you know?
Yeah.
But this from a person who thinks himself to death. And then we have the anecdote for fathers.
Yes. Yeah. Another cute little story about little kids.
Yeah. So we have a cute little story about little kids, which is about how the speaker's son wants to live in the place where he is now because there was no weather vane and he likes to look at the weather vane. Even though the other place was cool. And then We Are Seven, which is a similar tale as Simplicity of Children, but much darker because it's about this little girl who keeps saying, I have seven brothers and sisters, when a whole bunch of them are dead, and she doesn't recognize the difference between what it means to be living and dead. They're still alive to her.
Right. She visits there where they're buried, and she knows that they're buried there. You know, she talks to them.
Yeah.
When they're, yeah, it's I don't want to say bleak, because it's really not in a way.
Right.
I mean, it's naive, but I think also there's the transcendental angle of, you know, well, these people were your brothers and sisters at one point in your life. They'll never stop being your brothers and sisters, even though they, you know, they may be dead. And of course this, you know, a little girl, you know, in the poem clearly does not quite grasp what that difference between living and dead is. But I would say that I think part of the poem's point, if you will, is that in the fullness of time, maybe there isn't that much difference between living and dead anyway.
Right.
You know, like we're all of us, you know, we all have a very small amount of time where we're with each other.
Right.
So as long as you're still around, then the time that you had shared with somebody else is still around in its way. Because those, you know, when zooming on back, like I said, in the fullness of time, it's all doesn't really, it's all kind of the same amount of time in a way. But absolutely. it's another kind of from the wisdom of, you know, from the mouths of babes kind of deal, which happens a lot in lyrical ballads, which is not really what I was expecting. I can't tell you why I didn't expect it necessarily, but the, you know, thinking back now, of course, like, you know, children and the wisdom of babes is of course a kind of a deep vein to draw from when you're sort of setting out on a project like this. But I was really kind of, I was surprised and enjoyed just how much like Wordsworth clearly like really enjoys kids and talking to his kid and talking about his sweet little boy and how much Edward rules. You know, it's like, yeah, man, I know exactly what you're talking about. Yeah.
It seems to come from observation, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then we have the lines written in early spring, which are these, you know, it's a very hopeful poem about, you know, if these thoughts may not prevent, if such be of my creed the plan, have I not reason to lament what man has made of man? When you go out and have those moments of blissful reconnection, it does make you sad that we just seem intent on destroying each other. Mm-hmm. And then we have the thorn. So this one hit you pretty hard, huh?
It did. And in kind of a number of ways. So the thorn is, I think for one, it's very interesting. And you could probably give me a little more insight into the poetical aspects of this. So most of these poems, they have clear stanzas, but they're not like numbered stanzas. Or some stanzas will be very long, or they're clear, like, you know, sections and segments. And the thorn is one of the longer poems, but it is, I think, other than the Rime of the Ancient Mariner, it's the only one broken out into, numbered stanzas. Mm. Is that right? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
But the thorn is a poem where our narrator, our sort of point of view voice, is out on of course, a melancholy hilltop somewhere.
Mm-hmm. Like
and
you do.
finds an interesting spot. It's this, you know, particular place on the mountain where there's a tenacious kind of thorn bush is growing next to a small pool and a little tufted hillock of moss. Mm-hmm. And I think it says at first like, oh, it could be the grave of an infant, but no infant grave could be this pretty. And so of course it comes to pass that there's a woman who comes up to that place, every night and weeps and moans and cries, "Oh misery, oh misery, oh woe is me, oh misery." And it comes to pass that our narrator finds out that this was a woman who had been engaged to be married to a man, a low-down dirty dog who ran off to marry another maid after he had already impregnated her. So there's it's left ambiguous as to whether this was an infanticide or was it, you know, a miscarriage or stillbirth. I think that's I'm right where that's left ambiguous, right? Like I read this and I don't think it's ever really explicitly
It's
said to be an infanticide.
It's hinted it could go either way. Some say it's one, some say it's the other, and then, you know, there's this weird occurrence at the site, which may be supernatural or may not be supernatural, but we can't know for certain the specifics of, you know, the cause of this death, if there even was a death.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
It is really, I think the last, and the kind of the last three stanzas, I think are it's the real punch. Where the point of view, you know, the poet says, "I've heard the scarlet moss is red with drops of that poor infant's blood, but kill a newborn infant thus? I do not think she could. Some say if to the pond you go and fix on it a steady view, the shadow of a babe you trace, a baby and a baby's face, and that it looks at you. Whene'er you look on it, 'tis plain, the baby looks at you again." And some had sworn an oath that she should be brought to public justice brought. And for the little infant's bones with spades they would have sought. But then the beauteous hill of moss before their eyes began to stir. And for full 50 yards around the grass it shook upon the ground. All do still aver the little babe is buried there beneath that hill of moss so fair. And that was really... I mean, that's kind of that intrusion of the supernatural again.
Right.
And was one that was very affecting to me. Like to approach like, well, this, you know, this woman must be brought to justice must be done for this little infant. But to do that is an injustice to where this infant is now. It would be a deeper injustice to this poor child, to this being.
Yeah,
who has an existence now as this place.
Yeah.
You know, to take that away.
And it comes up in another Wordsworth poem, The Ruined Cottage. What is the justice here? Right?
Right.
Like what could you possibly do?
Yeah.
Whether or not this baby was stillborn or whether or not he died, there's suffering. Mm. And who are we really to say that it is just suffering or unjust suffering? What seems to matter to him is just that the suffering is there. Not
right.
Like,
yeah.
Justice. You know, it's weird because in this poem and in a couple of other poems, I'm sort of anticipating later Wordsworth poems, there is this question of what the just action is. And there seems to be this thing in Wordsworth that says, just let it be.
Mm-hmm.
Sort of like accept and love and empathize and just let it be. Because the worst thing you could do is make this kind of, even for the right intentions, your intervention would be harmful here, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's as you said, like, even if you know, I'm sorry, it makes me go back to the stupid Simpsons quotes, "Dig him up."
Right.
Can't we have one community meeting without digging up a corpse? You know, dig up his grave. But you know, what would that accomplish? What would any of this really accomplish? Can we not let this person grieve? Can we not let this be? And he even frames, you know, I thought this was pretty craftily done. He frames the supernatural as the gossip of the town. Right. Mm-hmm. So we both get it and don't get it. We get it filtered through hearsay. You know what I mean? It's mm-hmm. it's an interesting little trick, but it's, you know, how does it end? I cannot tell how this may be, but plain it is, the thorn is bound with heavy tufts of moss that strive to drag it to the ground. And this I know full many a time when she was on the mountain high, by day and in the silent night, when all the stars shone clear and bright, that I have heard her cry, "Oh misery, oh misery, oh woe is me, oh misery." I can't really say. I don't know what the right thing to do is. All I know is mm-hmm. that there's this woman who goes up there and she's in pain.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, it's, again, it's sort of like, what would you have us do? And for me, that was the most heartbreaking part of so many of the poems in here. You know, there's that desire to do something, but what do you do?
Yeah.
Last of the Flock. This is another one about sort of economic dwindling.
right.
A shepherd who sells off his flock one by one until he's literally got the lost one. And then, The Dungeon, another extract from the same play as The Foster Mother.
Hmm.
And
then, now was that play ever actually published as a whole piece?
I'm sure it has been now.
Oh, okay. But not in the lifetimes of the,
I don't think so.
Yeah.
Unless Coleridge published it at some point to make money, cause he needed it at the end.
he needed to pay those laudanum bills.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's in their own weird ways, both of them ended up, you know, pretty sad. Coleridge, you know, sort of trying to manage his addiction as best he could, and Wordsworth as just an arch conservative partisan hack. You know, at least Coleridge's turn towards the conservative was bizarre. You know, he was advocating for rule by clerisy and this weird kind of mystical theological sect that should guide the king, you know. At least that's interesting.
I like that it's kind of like the, it's a bit like kind of the conspiracy theorizing about the Jesuits, but he's saying like, no, we should do that.
Yes. Conspiracy theory, but make it real.
But yeah.
But anyway, and then after that, you have The Mad Mother. I mean, there are all these poems about mothers and mm-hmm. children. The Mad Mother, and then The Idiot Boy. And The Idiot Boy is another one of the longer poems in here. The Idiot Boy, you know, Wordsworth's term, his time's term, not ours. But this kid who either is developmentally delayed or he is deaf and can't speak. Well, not deaf, but mute. He can't mm-hmm. speak. It's uncertain what exactly that means. And so his father is gone somewhere, and his mother is nursing a friend of theirs who's very sick, and they don't think she'll last the night. And the only person they have to get the doctor is the idiot boy. And so she puts him on the pony and sends him out and says, just go out there, get the doctor and bring him back. And then he wanders off. So the mother goes looking for the doctor, and then can't find the boy and is panicked and looking and looking and looking. And then the neighbor lady in the middle of the night starts feeling better and just gets up and says, you know, I got to find both of them, and gets up and goes looking. And they go, and the idiot boy is just chilling. He's just hanging by a waterfall with the horse watching. And I, you know, as a very anxious parent, this hit close to home.
Yeah.
This was the one when I was reading it, I was really, really just, you know, this one was hitting me because, you know, just thinking about my son being out of my sight, and this is my son's, my older son, both of my kids. My older son is in kindergarten. My younger son is going to preschool for the first time. And it's a huge adjustment after the whole past, you know, 2 years. This is very, very frightening, and I'm constantly worrying about, you know, whether or not my kids are okay. And, you know, it was tough to read this one because all of a parent's anxieties get elevated, and then at the end, everything's fine. And so I had recourse to ask a friend of mine who is a romanticist, you know, what do you make of this? And she had this compelling insight. She said her way of reading this is that the idiot boy is not the idiot boy. The idiot boy is, he's kind of got a better grasp of the situation, a better understanding of the situation than anyone else. And he knows that everything's going to be just fine. And so he's just chilling. She sort of sees him as not really, as possibly not even the quote unquote mental deficient that his town takes him for, that they've projected onto him this mental disability that he just doesn't have. And he knows everything's going to be okay, so he just goes and hangs and watches the waterfall. That was sort of her reading. And I think there's stuff in there to sort of warrant that. It's sort of like turning the tables on that anxiety. You know, when you get to the end, now Johnny all night long had heard the owls in tuneful concert strive. No doubt, too, he the moon had seen, for in the moonlight he had been from eight o'clock till five. And thus to Betty's question he made answer like a traveler bold. His very words I give to you. The cocks did crow, to who, and the sun did shine so cold. Thus answered Johnny in his glory, and that was all his travel story. Where were you? What have you been? You know, I was hanging.
Yeah. It's almost like almost a Shaggy Dog story.
It is in this weird way, right?
It just has this kind of just this this long poem, and it's got a bathos ending.
So then we have the meditation on the Thames, and then the expostulation and reply. Expostulation and reply and tables turned are sort of always, you know, linked together. These two little ballads about, you know, put the books down and go experience things for real.
Touch grass, we might say today.
Yeah. And then we have the sketch about the old man traveling. And so this is an old man going to see his son who's in the hospital at Falmouth, and that's it. I mean, it's 20 lines, which are just like, hey, old man, where are you walking to? I'm walking to Falmouth to see my son. He's sick. He's a mariner. That's it.
Yeah.
It's another one of these sort of like observation poems. And then you have the complaint of a forsaken Indian woman, this kind of poem about, again, another mother. I mean, mothers are so prevalent in this volume.
Yeah.
This poem about, you know, this supposed Native American custom of leaving behind, you know, the people who can't go with you on the journey. Like if they're sick or stranded, you leave them with just enough and say, hey, man, we got to go. If you can catch up, catch up.
Yeah.
And so this is a mother leaving her children behind dying. Right.
Right. Yeah.
They seem to have their eyes on these particular kinds of situations. I mean, it's become such a cliche trope. Won't someone think of the children? But that's kind of sort of what they keep doing here.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
What is it to be a parent dispossessed when you have someone you have to care for and you can't do that?
And I would think that the time, this kind of places them in a, well, really it was a shift in thinking about children, which had been like in Western Europe and in Britain specifically, like it seems like there's, it's, I don't want to, it'll make people seem like real monsters. There's a kind of, I forget which crank psychologist this was, but there was this guy who had a theory about difference. You could periodize human history into, different periods of how people related to small children. Mm-hmm. So that you had the infanticide period of the ancient world and classical world. And then you had the kind of neglect and abuse period of the Middle Ages into the early modern. And then you have the modern conception of parenting after that. Right. And it was this contention that the contention was not unreasonably would conclude that, like, well, a child growing up in these different societies would be psychologically very different.
Right.
Sort of concomitant with how children were valued or viewed in these different phases. And then that affects how they behaved as adults. It's the kind of theory that there's no way on God's green earth you could ever confirm or deny. So, which means it's limited in the kind of what it can do. But I do think that there's something to be said for this idea of, there's definitely some, now that's something we can prove is that there was a distinct shift in attitudes toward children and the valuing of children and even the kind of like investing time and attention in children, which was not always a guaranteed thing, but it started to become one. I guess beginning before these guys' time, but that was a part of a shift in the culture. And I think it is interesting that that's one of their real hobby horses. That's one of their real, think of the children. And that was kind of cutting edge in a way. That was a newer, or at least, a kind of, it was a concept that was having a moment of flourishing at the time.
Absolutely. It's just such a fascinating thing that it's typically mothers with children. It's these speakers talking to their sons, but when it's this observational poetic, it's usually mothers with children. I don't know where to go with that. I'm sure 1,000 dissertations have been written on that. It's just this observation that I can make right now. And then we end with the convict, which apparently was so grim that they dropped it from subsequent editions. it's another poem of witness of someone wishing they could have a second chance.
Yeah.
And that gets us, through the rest of the 1798 lyrical ballads. It's interesting to me. Well, okay. The rest of it, aside from Tintern Abbey, which we're going to tackle on its own episode. Mm-hmm. It really is interesting to me that the hints of the transcendental pantheistic stuff that really comes full force in Tintern Abbey are there. Mm-hmm. And Wordsworth isn't going full on transcendental yet. Like, he's got other poems in the later volume that really sort of go full bore on that. But this sort of keeps to a kind of, I almost want to say naturalistic view, that it's much more interested in these sort of poems of witness or the kind of simple poems about, hey, it's a nice day, let's go hang. Right. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
Like some of the more famous ones really, really are they're not here yet, which I thought was really kind of funny. Some of the ones that I was expecting to see aren't here. And so I'm curious to see, like, what the full or what the later edition adds. Let's put it that way. I'm sort of anticipating where it's going to go and what it's going to do. So anyway, that's I guess where I am with this. It was an insightful read. It was an eye-opening read to try to think through what it would have been like to read it at the time. And I think we sort of did the historicizing, what you call the table setting one, where, I still stand by the argument that this isn't necessarily all that different from the other sort of rural stuff that was being produced at the time. It just seems to have this other kind of eye where it could go moralistic. It just pulls back, mm-hmm. you know, and
yeah.
it's pushing at a little bit more than the bucolic, but it's not there yet.
Yeah. Yeah. Clearly. Yeah. yeah.
So, all right. Does that do as much justice as we can to the 1798 volume aside from Tintern Abbey?
I mean, I think so. But as always, I would urge our listeners to read it for themselves. I mean, this is one that's really, this is one I think that is really rewarding for what I would call lunch break reading.
Mm-hmm.
It's very like, you know, if you can, like it's the fall. It's cool enough. I mean, it's trying to, at least here in Alabama. we're mm-hmm. still getting up to 80 during the day, but we're getting there. It's the right kind of, you know, get yourself a, I ended up actually just printing off the Project Gutenberg has the 1798 edition. I just printed it off and put some binder clips on that mamma jamma
yeah.
and, would sit out on the bench, you know, on my lunch break at work and read a couple of poems and, you know, see for yourself. What we're talking about here, because there really is something else that I ended up doing, and you've recommended it before, Claude, and I wanted to tell you about this. I read them aloud to myself.
Mm-hmm.
And that has been the single most effective, like, pro tip mm-hmm. for comprehending poetry I have ever encountered in my life. And I want to thank you for that.
But you kind of have it to really hear is, it, you know,
you have to hear it. You have to hear it to hear the rhythms, to hear where things hit, to hear where, and as you're speaking it, like your rhythm modulates, like as you feel where you feel where the language is speeding up and you feel where the language is taking a break and you feel the rise and fall of it.
Mm-hmm.
It's really something. I could not compare that. I don't know what other kind of, you know, poetry to compare it to. I don't know if Wordsworth and Coleridge are specifically spectacularly great at it. I'll mm-hmm. just have to read more poetry to find out. But I was really affected by the experience of reading these poems aloud, which is what they were intended for. Mm-hmm. You know, that's how these kinds of works would be typically enjoyed a lot of the time, is that this was something you would do like at a, you know, a dinner party or something. It was like, yeah. Oh, I've got these new poems. Let us read them. You know, like that was part of how they were experienced. And yeah. I would highly recommend that. So if you have a place you can go on your lunch break where you can mutter to yourself while you're reading, try it out.
All right. Or if you're in the city, you can just walk down the street doing that anyway. So you're
okay. Yeah. Yeah. No one's going to hassle you.
No. Know. Oh man. Well, I think that sort of brings it to a close. So next episode we'll finish up the 1798 edition with a sort of close read of just Tintern Abbey. Mm-hmm. And then we'll take a look at the 1800 edition to see sort of what's the difference. Like, what did they do to this thing? They added a bunch to it, but they also rearranged some things. So you don't start off with Rime of the Ancient Mariner. And I'm still trying to get my head around that. Like, is that a better choice? Is that a worse choice? What kind of choice is that? But we'll see. We'll see. All right, so that's as much of Lyrical Ballads as I can do right now. Hope you enjoyed. You know, please check out some of the other podcasts on the Agora Network and check out the Agoraphobia. That's the network's Halloween stuff. We've been really busy over there, and you'll find some great shows. Just all of us got together with all kinds of weird observations that maybe are in our wheelhouse or maybe outside of our wheelhouse, to just kind of, you know, play around with what it is to be in the spooky season. So keep checking that out.
Absolutely.
Right. So we'll see you next time.